We could talk to the animals. Just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee.
This is Animals Today, featuring discussions about domestic pets, wild animals, and encouraging compassion and respect for all living creatures. Live from Palm Springs, here's Dr. Lori Kirshner.
Study every creature's language so I could speak to all of them on sight. If friends said, can he talk a crab or maybe pelican? You'd say like hell he can, and you'd be right. So if you just stop and think of it, there ain't no doubt of it. I'm gonna win a place in history. A man who walks with the animals, talks with the animals, grunts and squeaks and squawks with the animals. And they could squeak and squawk and speak and talk to me.
Here, kitty kitty.
Hi, welcome. Good morning. Welcome to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. We have a real treat for you today with a very special guest. So I'm very anxious to get started here. There is a lot to learn this hour, and I know you're going to enjoy today's show very much on Animals Today. Did you know that one of the fastest growing areas of study in law schools is animal law? Today we are pleased to have the father of the animal law movement in the United States, the person regarded as the first animal rights attorney, Professor Hank Mark Holzer. Henry Holzer is Professor Emeritus at Brooklyn Law School and is here to tell us about the early days of the animal law movement. Welcome to Animals Today, Hank.
Good morning.
You didn't start out your legal career with any specific interest in animals. You were and are a constitutional law expert.
Correct.
How did you get involved in legal issues concerning animals?
Well, what happened was I was practicing for about 10 years, and I received a solicitation one day in the mail from a woman named Alice Harrington, who had started and was then running an organization called Friends of Animals, which is still around. And Alice's principal two activities dealt with, one, giving low-income people, middle-income people, vouchers for low-cost spay-neuter, in effect deferring. So they'd get donations into Friends of Animals, and then they would give vouchers to people who could use them with participating veterinarians who would do low-cost spay-neuter, which was an anti-population, overpopulation activity, which was very well-founded, very important, and it still is. And her other activity dealt with the annual Canadian slaughter of harp seals on the ice floes in Canada, which I won't get into in detail. And one day I got a solicitation. I sent her a contribution. And I guess I sent her this was about 25 or 30 years ago. I sent her a contribution, and I guess the letter was on my legal letterhead. So Alice, who was always a pretty good operator, called me and invited us to dinner, Eric and I to dinner, and we went. It was a very pleasant dinner. And the conversation drifted from one thing to another, and eventually she told me about a 1957 federal law, about which I had no idea at all, called the Federal Humane Slaughter Law, which provided, in essence, that livestock animals, before they could be slaughtered, had to be, quote, rendered insensible by a single blow that was rapid and effective, end quote. The idea was to spare them as much suffering as possible before they were actually slaughtered, and wound up as food at Ralph's or Vaughn's or someplace. And in passing, she mentioned that this render insensible requirement applied to every method of slaughter except if at the end of the process the livestock animal was going to be killed by a ritual throat cut, a shechita, which is a Jewish ritual throat cut. And as soon as I heard that, I told her that that exemption from a generally applicable statute for religious reasons arguably violated the federal constitution, specifically the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which some people interpret as meaning that the federal government can't have anything to do with religion. Of course, what found it had to do with religion here was creating an exemption for a particular method of slaughter pertaining to one and perhaps another religious faith.
So let me just clarify this for our listeners. The Federal Humane Slaughter Act had in it an exemption for those religious people. I guess it's part of the Jewish religion, part of keeping kosher, part of the kosher killing was the exemption.
Yeah, and the purpose of the exemption was to, there's a double negative here, was to make sure that the animal was not rendered insensible, because allegedly Jewish law required an animal who was slaughtered for food to be sensible, in other words, to be conscious.
Right, and they were exempt, so...
They didn't have to be conscious.
Correct, they didn't have to be
exactly.
Conscious. Okay.
And one thing led to another, and I started a federal constitutional lawsuit about that eventually went to the U.S. Supreme Court of the United States. And the United States Supreme Court decided, no, that exemption was okay. And the decision was essentially on policy grounds rather than on constitutional grounds, by which I mean I think they were afraid to, believe it or not, afraid to hold that an exemption which had, no pun intended, been carved into a federal statute was unconstitutional. And of course, the people with whom I became involved in that lawsuit were people who were involved in animal protection, although their view of what was necessary to protect animals differed from person to person and organization to organization. But as I was involved with them in this lawsuit, I learned more and more about what was happening to animals, and the more I heard, now moving away from constitutional issues, just looking at humane issues, the more and more I was bothered and disturbed. So I began to set up, to organize efforts on behalf of animals, using the law as leverage to help them, not simply by getting legislation passed, but by creating an awareness among lawyers that this was potentially a field of law like malpractice or securities law or criminal law that needed to be needed to exist and be identified as a separate field of law, which, as you said, today it is. I mean, animal law, for example, is taught in, I don't know, 115 law schools out of maybe 150 in America.
Hank, at the time, did you see personally witness how animals were being slaughtered at that time before you took this on?
Well, when I started the case, I didn't go to a slaughterhouse, but I got a film of a slaughterhouse. And as a matter of fact, as you know, that immediately caused me to become a vegetarian as soon as I actually saw this process. I mean, the fact is that, you know, I was brought up like most people, and, you know, meat is meat. It, somehow it gets on the table, and you eat it without any thought, to my chagrin and embarrassment even, without any thought to how it got there. As a kid and as an adolescent, a teenager, even in the Army, I mean, and in law school, until my meeting with Alice, which opened this whole door for me. It raised my consciousness, so to speak, so that I realized that there was a lot going on here, not only insofar as the slaughter of livestock animals was concerned, but how they were raised, farming. I know you've done shows on factory farming, rodeos, circuses, vivisection, overpopulation, breeding, and on and on and on. So it was that one contribution to Friends of Animals and that one dinner conversation and that one lawsuit that really started this whole field, because once we realized what was going on and once we began the case and the case attracted as much publicity as it did, it became evident that something was beginning to crystallize. So
what year was this, Hank?
Well, the case itself was 1971, I think, a long time ago. And in one sense, it's gone very quickly. When you look around and see everything that exists now in animal law. It is a discrete, clearly identified, recognized field of law today. As a matter of fact, one reason these law school courses exist is because some folks got together and created a case book for teaching these courses in law schools. And the case book, the existence of the case book, legitimized this field to a considerable extent. But there's law reviews, journals that are devoted to this now. There are groups of lawyers. Animal Legal Defense Fund, which does a great job, came out of a meeting I held with the ISAR, International Society for Animal Rights, back in the early 80s. And the biggest Joyce Tischler attended that and then went out and formed with others Animal Legal Defense Fund, which has done great work and which has student chapters all over the country in law schools.
Hank, hi, it's Peter. Good morning.
Hi.
Hey, maybe you can go back a little bit and tell us a little bit about the case that you argued and how you met Helen Jones and where she fits into the story.
Well, when Alice told me the story and I told her that it was that the exemptions were unconstitutional, she invited me to meet with her board of directors, and both she and I thought it was for the purpose of getting their approval for Friends of Animals to support this case, both financially and by providing plaintiffs, that is, people who would sue the Department of Agriculture, which had the responsibility legislatively for administering the federal slaughter law. And I met with them, and after my explanation and their questions and my answers, they wished me good luck and just about pushed me out the door. And when I inquired why, they said that they wouldn't be want to be thought to be anti-Semitic, which was absurd. And I asked the chairman whether he was. And of course, he said he wasn't. And I asked him what he had to worry about if he wasn't.
Yeah.
And that, of course, went nowhere. So after a while, I was sick and tired of nobody coming, stepping up to the plate, so I started the lawsuit myself. And that, of course, garnered, with myself, not only as the lawyer, but as the plaintiff as well.
You must have encountered a lot of resistance with rabbis and people of the Jewish faith.
And organized Jewry. And, of course, Time magazine called me a Jewish atheist. And anyhow, it got a lot of notice. And I began to get calls from humane organizations who thought this was a great thing to do. And when I asked them for help financially and more importantly, to get some better plaintiffs than I, they all ran from me like the plague. I think erased all their memory of the conversations.
Wow.
Until a woman named Helen Jones called, who was president of an organization called the National Catholic Society for Animal Welfare. She was one of the organizers of HSUS years ago in the 50s and left very early on because she didn't like the direction they were headed. And she deliberately called her organization NCSAW as a reproach to the Catholic Church. She was Catholic. Because of their terrible, terrible attitude and track record historically toward animals. So that's why she called it the National Catholic Society for Animal Welfare and then went out and did all these pro-animal things.
Very interesting.
So anyway, she called, and I thought it was another one of these, we're with you but don't mention our name calls.
Right.
And I unloaded on her, and when I was finished, she laughed, and she said, no, she'd been looking for somebody. She wasn't a lawyer, but she understood this. She was looking for 13 years for some lawyer who would undertake this. So I discontinued the case I brought myself, and she got a bunch of plaintiffs for me and put the weight of the organization behind the case. And my relationship with her then exposed me to even more knowledge and information about the animal world, so to speak.
Yeah.
Zoos and whatnot.
Right. Let's stop here. I'm anxious to hear the rest. Don't go away. You're listening to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. We're speaking to Professor Hank Holzer about the early history of the animal rights law movement and more with Professor Holzer right here on Animals Today on News Talk 920 KPSI.
You're listening to News Talk 920 KPSI.
Welcome back to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. We're speaking to Professor Hank Holzer, who many regard, as do I, as our country's first animal rights attorney. We're learning about the early history of the animal rights law movement, and Professor Holzer was telling us about the Federal Humane Slaughter Act. If you missed last segment, it was very interesting. The Federal Humane Slaughter Act, which was passed, and it included an exemption for kosher ritual slaughtering, and this exemption concerned the requirement to render the animal insensible prior to killing it. The kosher ritual slaughtering, they wanted to be exempt from this, that you had to render the animal insensible. So they would kill it when the animal was conscious and sensible. Ultimately, Professor Holzer determined that this was a constitutional question because religion here is involved, so filed suit and really came into a lot of resistance. And no one really wanted to step up to the plate. He finally met up with a woman by the name of Helen Jones, who is with the National Catholic Society for Animal Welfare.
And Hank, so tell us about these plaintiffs that you were able to attract along with Ms. Jones.
Peter, there's a doctrine, as you know, in law called standing to sue. And the reason for it is that there has to be some measure of control about who can sue in these so-called public issue type cases. In other words, Congress passes a law, it contains an exemption. Some people think it's unconstitutional. Now, who can sue about it? Well, if anybody can sue about anything, obviously that's unwieldy and that won't work in a judicial system. On the other hand, if nobody can sue, then that won't work in a judicial system. So the Constitution says you have to have what's called a case of controversy. And the Supreme Court over the years has developed rules and criteria for what constitutes a case or controversy and who can sue. I was concerned that because we were invoking the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, that is, Congress can't establish a religion or favor religion, if you will, that we have a broad spectrum of plaintiffs representing various kinds of interests. In other words, people who could claim that they were affected by the exemption. So I had Helen Jones go out and get for me vegetarians, vegans, Catholics, Jews, meat eaters, non-meat eaters, each of whom could individually assert a different kind of interest. For example, a Catholic might say, or a Christian might say, I don't want to eat meat that was slaughtered in a kosher way, and the animal was not rendered insensible because that offends my religion. I mean, this is a simple, even crude example. A vegetarian could say, I don't want to eat meat of an animal. I wouldn't eat meat of an animal, any animal under any circumstances, but certainly not an animal that was not rendered insensible. In other words, what I needed was a spectrum of plaintiffs representing different interests. Now, what your audience may find very interesting is this, that under federal civil practice rules for courts, there is a provision where somebody can sue as a, quote, next friend, quote, of somebody else. And it's intended mostly to sue on behalf of minors, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Not coal miners, but children.
Right.
And it's called the next almost a guardian type provision. Among the plaintiffs that I listed in this lawsuit were, quote, all livestock animals now or hereafter awaiting slaughter in the United States, end quote. And among all these, there must have been a dozen other plaintiffs and individuals, humans, and organizations. But I got somebody to sue as next friend of livestock animals. When the case was brought, the government, which was the defendant, the Secretary of Agriculture.
Oh, Hank, where was this case brought, by the way?
In the federal court in New York, and actually the same court where they're going to try some of these Guantanamo people.
Oh.
Federal U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York in Manhattan.
Got it.
And the government, as soon as the case was filed, moved to dismiss it on various grounds. And one of the grounds they moved to dismiss it on was that none of these, I don't know, there must have been 15 by the time we were done, none of these 15 plaintiffs had, quote, standing to sue, which is to say none of them had a sufficient interest in the case, in the exemption, to warrant their being able to sue. And we fought that out bitterly. And finally, the district court, the trial court, held that, in effect, we're not even going to talk about standing because among all these plaintiffs, somebody surely must have standing. It was kind of a cop-out, but one that I found very desirable and even amusing, because I had thrown so much at them in the way of plaintiffs that they figured that somewhere in there somebody had standing. The significance of that is they did not specifically delineate the livestock animal plaintiffs that I had created. So one could say that there, and I have often, that there is some law out there to the effect that in a federal case, if the facts are right, one can actually, human, can actually bring an action as next friend of an animal. Indeed, I mentioned before that in these animal law courses that are taught all around the country now in various law schools, that they use a case book that's been written for it. And that this case, Jones against Butts, because I made her the lead plaintiff, is contained, and they talk about this very issue, standing to sue on behalf of animals.
Tell us who the lead plaintiff again was.
Helen Jones.
And I'm sorry, the defendant.
Earl Butts was the Secretary of Agriculture.
Got it, Secretary of Agriculture.
Agriculture had the responsibility for enforcement of the federal humane slaughter law.
Okay, so describe the course of the suit.
Well, in those days, if you brought a challenge against a constitutional challenge against the federal statute, instead of having a single federal district judge hear it, you were entitled to what was called a three-judge court. The judge before whom it was brought, after scrutinizing the papers and seeing that indeed it was a constitutional challenge to a federal statute, convenes a three-judge court. So we had three federal district judges sitting on this case. And the beauty of that was that from a determination of that court, you wouldn't have to go through the typical next level, which is the Federal Court of Appeals. You could go right to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the three-judge court decided that somebody had standing and that something had standing. But the exemption was not unconstitutional, which I guess is synonymous with saying it is constitutional. In any event, we lost. And I then took an appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States, and ultimately, after some briefing back and forth, they ruled that the three-judge court was correct and that it was not unconstitutional, that it was constitutionally exemption. And there are various cases in the Supreme Court dealing with other kinds of religious exemptions, and they tend to go one way or another. And the fact that they go one way or another simply underscores what Justice Thomas said some years back, that the jurisprudence, the Establishment Clause jurisprudence of the Supreme Court is a, quote, shambles, quote, and that there's really, appears to be really no consistent principle, and that they decide these cases and these exemptions specifically on an ad hoc basis. I mean, an example is that years ago, Justice Douglas wrote an opinion holding that the Amish didn't have to withhold Social Security on their employees, as everyone else does, because it's part of the Amish religion to take care of their elderly, and being forced to contribute to the Social Security program on behalf of their employees somehow interfered with their free exercise, which is the other religion clause, free exercise of religion. I
mean, so was that they were exempt?
Yes.
Wow.
They're patently absurd.
Wow.
But it simply illustrates how, and then of course the question, what about the Indians and the use of peyote, which is for the Indians a religious sacrament? Is that okay? You and I can't use peyote, I mean, not legally, but the Indians can.
Wow, interesting.
It's part of their sacrament, and to deny them that would be a violation of their free exercise of religion. So the question is the exemption an establishment of religion? Because what the exemptions say in these instances is that everybody has to do A, but, or X, but
except,
that the religionists are exempt.
Right. Right, and a lot of legal people would say this is unconstitutional.
Well, that's right, and it is. I mean, in the sense that it really is, that they said it wasn't.
Right. So, Hank, over the past 35 years, or since you tried to fight this case, has anything like this been brought up again or attempted again?
On the ritual slaughter case?
Yes, on the ritual slaughter.
Not yet, but I've had the last summer 5 law students working on research because the Animal Legal Defense Fund and International Society for Animal Rights is considering bringing the case again if we can figure out some way, and I think I can.
Way to go.
To get out from under the precedent that was established back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And, you know, just as a footnote, folks, to this, it's important to realize that while we talk about animal law, and there are lots of other examples, like, you know, landlords who won't permit animals, and can you leave money in your will to animals, etc., there are some very serious and very interesting constitutional law questions, which involve animals, because what we've been discussing this morning is really constitutional law. It has to deal with an exemption which deals with animals. But nonetheless, we're talking about the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. And not to get into it now, but as you know, a recent example of that is the Stevens case, where I saw put in a friend of the court brief in the Supreme Court, which deals with these crush videos. And there you're again talking about the First Amendment. You're talking about speech rather than religion. But it's another example of a very profoundly important constitutional issue that happens to deal with animals.
Right. In one of our conversations, Hank, you once gave me an example of what you believe, how people still view animals, or at least even dogs or pets. Give my listeners that example of a dog being hit by a car.
Well, I mean, the fact is that there are myriad examples of people viewing animals as inanimate objects. And if a dog is loose in a front yard, jumps over the fence, and gets hit by a car, and the custodian runs out and the driver gets out of the car and now the animal's dead in the road, the driver's apt to say, oh my God, I'm sorry, but the dog ran out and I couldn't stop, but I'll get you another one.
Right. As simple
now,
as that.
When he says, I'll get you another one, or we have to move, so we have to dump the cat at the shelter because we can't take it across country, or whatever.
Right.
They are really acting on the basis of something that was said a couple of hundred years ago by a French mathematician, so-called philosopher named René Descartes, D-E-C-A-R-T-E-S, which is that animals are essentially inanimate objects. Descartes held that lacking a soul, which of course everyone lacks, they were mere automata, and he said clocks, inanimate objects, and therefore you could do anything you wanted to them, including what he and his followers did, which was vivisect them, and has cut them up alive.
Yeah.
Because they were no different from a chair or a table or a Cadillac. And it's that philosophy which finds itself manifested in attitudes toward animals today.
I mean,
you can look at any attitude toward animal that you don't like, that's wrong, and at the bottom you will find that it reflects a Cartesian view of animals, that they are indeed no different from inanimate objects. So you can kill them and eat them and
do as what you want,
display
right.
them and torture them and fight them and ride them and do whatever else you want
yeah.
to do to them.
You know, Hank, with the last couple minutes that we have, this is very important. I want to let my listeners hear this. You led a conference in the early 1980s, I believe, that really put animal law on the map. Tell us about that.
I felt that there were lawyers around the country who were interested in this or could be made interested in this. So Helen and I organized the conference in, I think, 82, and we scrounged the country for lawyers who we had heard on the grapevine were maybe interested in animal law or what would become animal law, issues involving animals. And we held a two-day conference in New York at Rockefeller Center and put on a dog and pony show, bad example, for 2 days with speakers. I took the lead in it. And out of it came a lot of networking. And one of the principal things that came out of it was Joyce Tischler and others organizing what's become the Animal Legal Defense Fund, and other people like Stephen Wise who have written and taught and practiced in this area and taught at places like Harvard animal rights courses. So and then I started something called the Animal Rights Law Review, Animal Rights Law Reporter, which was a monthly newsletter culling out from everything in the country, all the news in the country, everything pertaining to animal legal issues. And that got disseminated, and people met people. You know how it works.
Right.
And it grew into what it is today.
I know you receive, even as of up until today, lots of emails from law students asking about animal law. What specifically are they asking you, and what do you tell them?
Well, mostly they ask how they can make a career out of practicing just animal law, and unfortunately I have to tell them that we're still in essentially the first generation of this, and that other than the few national organizations that have staff lawyers, it's very difficult, if not impossible, in certain areas, like small areas, small cities, to make a living practicing animal law, although to their credit, there are a few people who do it. There's a fellow up in Spokane, Washington, of all places, which is not, you know, a metropolis exactly, who only practices animal law. Anything to do with animals, wills, trusts, negligence cases, etc., he'll do. And it's his great credit. But it's difficult, so I tell them to get a day job, both literally and figuratively. And there's plenty of pro bono work that one can do on the side for animals, like writing briefs, friend of the court briefs in appellate courts dealing with animal issues, like our Stevens case in the Supreme Court on the Crush videos.
Yeah. Our country's first animal rights attorney, Professor Hank Holzer. Thank you so much. We're going to have to talk about your IAR, International Society for Animal Rights, okay?
Anytime.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Okay, more with Dr. Peter Borchell, our animal behavior consultant, up with us next right here on Animals Today, News Talk 920 KPSI. Welcome back to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner, and commercial break, I'm pretty good at keeping up on animal news, but my
especially
studio,
Michael Vick news.
Yeah, that's especially Michael Vick news, that piece of, you know, but my studio technician just told me something I wasn't aware of. Tom, what were you saying?
It's that Michael Vick's coach had a press conference this past week and said that they won't be signing him back for the next year, that they don't, he's a third-string quarterback and they don't want him next year.
And what's the reason?
They just said he's not worth keeping around,
right,
really, for the team.
And he's... It came out so early in the season to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Yikes.
Wow.
Well.
So, I mean, maybe he's not fully back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, being discarded this quickly as a third-string quarterback.
Well, he did get his big bonus.
Yeah, tell us about that. I heard about that, which just irritated me.
There was some legal judgment about bonus that he had earned before he was arrested. And the question was, is he still entitled to that? And I guess it was determined he is. And it's 10 or 20 million, something in that.
Ridiculous.
And it's still coming to him?
That's the final judgment.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Tom, what do you think the real reason is they don't want him anymore, signing him up again? Do you think they're getting too much resistance from animal people?
I just think that for his style of play, his what he's contributing, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's too much bad publicity. It's too much just... with everything that's going on, he's constantly having to do his volunteer work, his mandated volunteer
work. Which he doesn't want to do anyway.
Which I don't think constitutes as volunteer work if you're mandated to do it.
Right, exactly. It's like paid volunteer. Right.
You know, so I think it's just, it's not worth it for them. They're a good team. They have a star quarterback. They have a decent backup. He's third string. Why keep around this much problem for somebody who's getting, you know, 10 minutes of playing time a year. It's just not worth it.
Has it been a burden on the league so far as you can tell? You know, when you're watching television broadcasts, they don't really show the protesters or show the signs.
Well, they said that Michael Vick has been the biggest non-story of the year.
Oh, wow.
He's just been such a nothing and a nobody in the NFL that everyone was expecting so much to be going on that nothing's really happened. There was a big outcry against him when he first signed up and first started. Again, because, you know, he only had that 3-game suspension to start his career again. Right. So there was a lot of backlash immediately. But pretty much after his first game, nobody cared about him anymore.
But, Tom, you think so? Or do you think there is a lot of protesting going on at the Eagles games that, of course, the television stations are not going to air, right? Because it's NFL and they're not going to...
I just think he's faded into nothing. Mm. You know what I mean? I think he's just become such a non-issue for the majority of
Isn't
sports
that great?
Fans.
Well, I wouldn't write him off yet.
Really?
I mean, he's a talented guy. There's the Canadian Football League, which I've always thought he'd end up in, and there's these talented quarterbacks. They come back in many reincarnations. Do you remember that old Boston College star Doug Flutie?
Yes.
He had a long career in the NFL and in the CFL as a sort of road warrior, and he had limited physical talents but was pretty crafty.
Wow.
Yeah, but so, I think it's a different time, too.
Okay.
With I think his biggest chance is probably to ever come back is, you know, multiple years down the line after playing in, like, the European League or the Canadian League or something like that. I don't imagine him being a starting quarterback in the NFL pretty much ever again. There's too much talent available that doesn't have this kind of baggage.
Got it.
That's great.
You know.
Great news, Tom.
I just figured you'd be interested in his disappearance in the public sector.
Yes, and Peter, what else do you have?
As you know, we are reading this wonderful book.
Planet Cat.
By Charon and Arden Moore, and it's basically a encyclopedia of all cool things related to cats. And we are constantly paging through this because it's so cute to read and would be a good gift. And if you've got a pair of cats, what is a good name for Cat A and Cat B?
Oh, Romeo and Juliet.
Exactly.
So Butter.
Peanut and Butter.
Oh, really?
I don't know.
Okay,
here's some of her favorites. Lewis and Clark, Lucy and Ethel, Macaroni and Cheese. Okay, and Rhett and Scarlet, Regis and Kathy, Puryear and Ives, Pride and Joy, Penn and Teller, Gin and Tonic. Do you like gin and tonic? We have a Ouzo and a Margarita.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
So there's a theme there. And what if you've got three cats?
Let's see. Low, Mary, and Low. What are the Three Stooges, Tom? Curly.
Curly. Low, Mary, and Low.
Curly.
No, yeah,
Mo.
Mo. Mo, Mary, and Curly.
Right.
There we go.
And there's Harpo, Chico, and Groucho.
Yeah.
Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. Nina Pinta and Santa Maria.
Okay.
Okay, so if you've got a trio of cats. Now, if you've got four cats.
Oh, boy. Let's
see.
What
do you name your four cats?
Paul, Ringo.
Okay.
Okay.
That's a good one.
Okay.
One that she likes is Mick, Keith, Charlie, and Ron. Who are
I don't know.
The Rolling Stones.
Oh. I thought you said Nick, not Mick.
Oh,
okay.
How about Kramer, Seinfeld, Elaine, and Costanza?
I like that.
And Bart, Lisa, Homer, and Marge.
Okay, that's good.
So it's a cute book, and I would I recommend it. What can I say?
Yeah, good. And so, you know, the clawing has become a big issue now. Oh, actually, we have Dr. Borchel on the line, which is great. We have we have a couple questions to ask him in the last seven, 8 minutes. Hi, Dr. Borchel.
Hi.
Boy, we had a lot of questions for you, but since we're running out of time, we're going to narrow this down. Let's see.
I like the question about the cat door problem that someone emailed you.
Oh, yeah. Fran emailed this. Fran asked Dr. Borchel, how do I train my 8-year-old cat to use a cat door? The door goes from one indoor area to another indoor area. Unless I lift up the cover, she just stands there.
Right. Well, if the door, the first thing to check is whether the door swings pretty easily, because cats will be inhibited if it's too difficult to go through.
Mm-hmm.
But I would prop it open so that they're used to going through frequently, and then very gradually, sort of let it come down a little bit so they have to brush against it a bit and move it a little bit to get through. So if you try to have them go through all at once when it's hanging down, they won't. If you put it up, they'll go through, and then slowly let the angle come down a little bit. You could probably do that with some tape or something like that.
Yeah.
So better than just pushing your cat through to show them how to do it.
Yes,
yeah, you don't want to shove them through, Peter.
Yeah, if you try to shove them through, they won't like that. Okay. They're going to avoid it.
Right. Okay. That's my husband wanting to shove a cat through. Okay, let's see. Dr. Borchel, this is actually coming from both my husband and I. It's a personal question for you. We have two cats. Rita is about, 9 years old, and Uzo is about 4 years old. They've always gotten along very well with each other, Dr. Borchel. The older cat, Rita, recently needed a procedure done at the vet's office and was brought home two nights ago with a cone on her head.
Oh.
And the younger cat is now hissing at her and wants nothing to do with her.
Yep.
And is there anything we should do? And hopefully the situation will get back to, quote, normal, in which they were great friends. I mean, it's almost like she doesn't even recognize the cat.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I don't think they do recognize the cat. It looks different. I've had cases where the cat will get, believe it or not, a haircut. You know, get shaved a bit from a procedure at the vet's, and they don't get recognized.
Wow, but don't they sense, smell the other cat?
I think it's much more visual.
Oh.
And once the cone comes off, they'll probably get back together slowly. What you might want to do is keep them a bit separate. So that we don't have a long history of hissing and growling.
Oh, but almost always they get back to a normal situation where they're good friends again?
They usually do, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Sometimes it happens all by itself, but it's a bit slow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Dr. Borchel, I must tell my listeners about your Snoot Loop, and I should preface this by saying this is not a commercial. This is not a paid advertisement. Dr. Borchel had absolutely no idea I was going to mention a Snoot Loop on Animals today. Susie, one of our dogs, is a maniac when it comes to walking on the leash. She's a very strong, 70-pound dog. She was rescued a few years ago from what I describe as somewhat feral situation.
Mm-hmm.
She never learned, and or we were unable to successfully train her to walk like a normal dog on a leash, despite and in addition to having a professional trainer attempt to train her to walk. She constantly pulls. Our walks look like this unruly dog is walking us, and she's the most energetic dog I've ever had to deal with or ever had in my life, so she needs her exercise, needs her activity. In fact, I'm a runner, and the best thing for Susie would be if she could go on some runs with me, but the situation was such that there's no way I could do that with her constant pulling of the leash. And anyways, Dr. Borchel, we tried out your Snoot Loop instead of our regular harness and leash, and I am so happy to say she's now a completely different dog on her walks, and this started from the very first walk with your Snoot Loop in use. The walks are now safer for all of us. We now feel we have control over Susie on the walks. We actually have slack in our leash, which we never had before. She runs with me. The walks are more enjoyable. She feels happier without us tugging at her constantly, trying to pull her back. So basically, she's learned what you would call positive behavior and a proper behavior in a positive way. So I want to first thank you, Dr. Borchel, and I'd like you to briefly describe to my listeners why the Snoot Loop was so effective in helping with our situation of the constant pulling.
Sure. Well, first of all, you've got a good dog. Sounds like a wonderful.
Yeah, we do.
The dog on the collar or a harness will often pull with a lot of force. I mean, you can maybe hold them if they're a small dog, but it's not so much how much force they pull you, it's what percentage of their force they pull.
Mm.
So a small dog that you can hold back, that's pulling at 100% of its force on a harness is learning the only way to get ahead is to pull. And I want to get ahead to sniff or to explore. So in order to do that, I have to pull like a bulldozer. You put them on a halter, a properly designed halter, where the pressure is on the nose like a horse halter. And then they learn, if I pull hard, I can't. But if I stop pulling, I'm given slack.
Right.
Then I can sniff and explore and so forth. A 1,200-pound horse can be controlled by a kid on a halter.
That's right. That's right. So pressure on the nose to the animal means stop, and that it cannot go forward until the pressure on the nose loop ceases.
Right.
And yeah, it's amazing. I mean, one finger on my leash, rather than full force of 80 pounds of force. So problems with dogs pulling on your walks, you're confused about who is walking who, you got to consider the snoot loop, which is snootloop.com, snootloop.com. Now we have about 40 seconds left, Dr. Worschel. There's other training behavior problems that this device can help with, right? Not just pulling, like barking and growling and jumping up and begging. How does that work, and how do we extend our training to that?
Well, most of the other problems involve the mouth, either barking or growling or biting. And the snoot loop was designed so that when you lift up, you can shut the dog's mouth and make it very clear to it that the mouth, which leads to barking, growling, or biting, is what we want the dog to control.
Mm.
We want us to control it so the dog can learn not to bark. So it's designed to be able to shut the mouth quickly, to release quickly, and make it very, very clear to the dog what it is we're trying to train him out of doing.
That's great. Dr. Worschel, thank you very much. Snootloop.com. It's outstanding, and it really worked for our problem. Thank you, Dr. Worschel.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. Thanks for joining us on Animals Today. I want to encourage you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.